meeting. As I said previously, we're going to have a panel with Mr. Osman Faruk-Loğlu, former Turkish ambassador in Washington, a career diplomat who is also a member of parliament. And we'll have Mr. Maciej Daranowski, director of the German Marshall Fund's Warsaw office. We'll have our friend Alvaro Vasconcelos, who was the former director of the European Union Institute for Security Studies. And we'll have General Rijvalisa Pint, former chief of staff of the armed forces. Now I'm going to give the floor to Mr. Osman Faruk-Loğlu. Just the reason why we have this specific panel, because we know what is the situation in Europe and around Europe. We've been talking about the security and defense of at 360 degrees. It has to do with what is happening in the south and in the east. It seemed to us to be interesting to include a participation in the north and the east, someone who follows all these issues on security and defense from Poland, because Poland is going to host the summit, but also someone who knows very well the issues in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean, what is considered to be the southern flank, our southern flank, in terms of security and defense in Europe. And the presence of Alvaro Vasconcelos, due to the fact that he was the former director of the European Union Institute for Security Studies, he was also director in Portugal of the International Strategic Studies Institute. It was a Portuguese think tank which was very important in analyzing and study of strategic and defense issues. And we have General Valença Pinto, is a former chief of staff of the armed forces. He is now retired, but of course he has the feeling for these issues, and he specialized in some areas. He will be very important presence for our debate. First of all, we would like to thank Mr. Loğlu for coming here. Thank you very much. You have the floor.
Well, thank you very much. I want to first thank the people of Portugal, the Portuguese Parliament, the National Defense Committee, and especially our moderator and Vice President of the Commission, Julio Miranda Calha, for their kind invitation to attend this very important and timely meeting. Portugal is at one end of the NATO alliance, and Turkey is at the other end, so I think it's appropriate that I have this opportunity to address this distinguished group. I'm not a NATO specialist. I've been involved in security affairs, but I'm not too familiar with NATO jargon and NATO lexicon. But be that as it may, I'm a firm believer in NATO as the paramount defense and security organization of the Euro-Atlantic community, and I'm a steady supporter of Turkey's membership in the alliance. Needless to say, the views I am about to express are my own. I suspect my government would not be in much disagreement with me, but still, I speak in my personal capacity. I've been asked by our hosts to address the challenges and threats emanating from NATO's southern flank. I will therefore first try to draw the main contours of the complex security environment in the south, then describe how Turkey fits into that picture, and conclude with what we should expect from the Warsaw Summit. In comparison to the south, NATO currently appears more focused on how to respond to Russian activities, power projections, and aggression in Europe and in the Caucasus. This is understandable up to a certain point, given the history of the region and the recent developments in Ukraine and the illegal annexation of Crimea. But my first proposition is that the risks and threats facing the alliance security are more imminent and more difficult to manage in the south than in the eastern flank. Despite all the Russian posturing, the eastern flank is security-wise relatively, and I say relatively, constant and settled, with little chance of an open armed conflict involving Russia. In contrast, the South is in a state of entropy, beset with civil war, sectarianism, terrorism, human displacements on a massive scale, and a myriad of other political, economic, and social problems. The situation in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen remains explosive. There is also the issues of weapons of mass destruction falling into the wrong hands, as well as energy and critical infrastructure security. Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and scores of other radical terrorist organizations continue to perpetrate their sinister attacks in the region and beyond. Again, in comparison to the East, the growing strategic Russian presence in the southern flank is not only new, but also more blatant, more comprehensive, and designed to be rather permanent, not transitory. Russians have significantly fortified their air, ground, and naval forces in Syria and the eastern Mediterranean. Russia is now NATO's southern flank neighbor. Given the volatility of regional dynamics, this new situation carries the seeds of a possible armed engagement with Russia, whether intended or accidental. Just remember the consequences of the Turkish downing of our Russian fighter jet some time ago. There are also the fears of the Gulf countries regarding Iran's ambitions and claims in the region. Moreover, the Iranian missile program is a further point of concern for NATO that has led to the development of NATO's missile defense project now in implementation. To recap, the following phenomena in the southern flank pose threats directly or indirectly to the security of alliance members: terror, sectarianism, failed states, refugees, Russian strategic search, and energy and critical infrastructure vulnerabilities. My second proposition is that in conjunction with the measures pertaining to the eastern flank, the Warsaw Summit should at the same time take a number of steps in response to the challenges from the southern flank. Much of this has been said earlier this morning. There has to be a coherence and a healthy balance between the resources devoted to the two problematic flanks of the alliance. My third proposition concerns the specifics, namely the decisions the summit should ideally take vis-à-vis the South. Number one, push aside the Cyprus barrier and open the way to an effective and multidimensional NATO-EU cooperation in the complex political space of the Middle East and the Gulf. There has to be a division of labor and burden sharing between NATO and the EU. There are things NATO can do better and must do better, and there are things that the EU can do better. And there has to be a joint effort between the two organizations. But in this context, I would say security is more important than politics. Number two, enhance and deepen security cooperation with the countries of the Middle East and the Gulf region with a view to interoperability, partnerships, and defense capacity building. The implementation of the defense and related security capacity building packages for Iraq and Jordan must be accelerated, and programs for other countries in the region should be developed as appropriate. Number three, build upon and make greater use of the Mediterranean Dialogue and the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative. Number four, develop an integrated, and this is very important, develop an integrated maritime strategy for the Black Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean while increasing NATO naval presence in the southern flank. Number five, review and renew, as needed, NATO's existing strategic concept that identified terrorism as a key security risk. The stand against terrorism must be unified and seamless to be effective. We are one country that is suffering from the consequences of this failure to make a seamless determination of who are the terrorists and what terrorism is. And unfortunately, there is not no unity of views on this issue, even between NATO. Number six, tailored assurance measures for Turkey, a package agreed by NATO in December 2015, must be fully implemented. Number seven, in this framework, being within range of both Iranian and Russian Syria-based missiles, Turkey's missile defense capabilities must be augmented. Deployment of Patriots might be part of the answer. Similarly, number eight, in order to respond to the southern flank to emergency crises with its rapid deployment capabilities, the establishment of a NATO force integration unit in Turkey might be highly advisable. I understand there are eight such units already in Europe, so why not one in Turkey? Finally, number nine, there must be sustained public diplomacy to explain the relevance and aims of NATO in this region, including why NATO has recently upgraded its relations with Israel. My final proposition, and I'm about to finish, is about Russia. I believe NATO's preoccupation with Russian moves, power projections, and harsh rhetoric is justified. But the tendency to go overboard and blame Russia beyond what is necessary is something that we must avoid. NATO must consider taking appropriate measures against Russia, and there is the message of there is no free lunch to Russia must be given at every opportunity. Yet the NATO message, while being firm and clear, must not be arrogant and threatening. In short, Russia phobia is not healthy and might overburden NATO's strategic thinking. This may come to you as a surprise coming from a person in Turkey. We have a lot of problems with Russia, but my own experience tells me that we have to be balanced in our approach to Russia. The German foreign minister recently made this point in his own manner as he reacted to the large-scale NATO military exercises in Europe. At the end of the day, the essential NATO approach to Russia in both the eastern and the southern flanks must be a double-D strategy, deterrence and dialogue. And I think we have heard these two concepts often this morning, and I'm very glad to hear this. Deter Russia by denial and by appropriate defense measures, but keep talking to Russia. There are areas of mutual interest, such as ending the war in Syria and defeating the Islamic State. Therefore, the better option is to elaborate and dwell on points of convergence with Russia rather than on points of divergence with Russia. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador. I will wish to give the floor to Mr. Michael Baranovsky, the head of the Marshall Fund of Warsaw.
It's truly wonderful to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation to the Parliament, to your personally, and the committee. It's my first time in Lisbon. It's quite a trip, in fact, from the very eastern flank of our alliance to the very western shores of Europe. And it's particularly interesting for me to be participating in this conversation to see also how the perceptions of threats to NATO to the alliance as a whole is seen from a place that is quite geographically removed comparing to my home city of Warsaw, which is in fact quite close to the eastern flank directly. You asked me to approach my presentation from a perspective of how things look from Warsaw, both in terms of preparation for the summit itself, which we are going to commence in 2 weeks and 1 day, the threat perception, what we expect, and in fact a lot is on the table already coming from the NATO ministerial 2 weeks ago. Let me just say in the very beginning that I think the conversation about who has the bigger problem, the eastern flank or the southern flank, is not the most productive one. There is an agreement also in Warsaw that NATO needs to deal with threats really in the 360 degrees. Yes, for us, the threats from Russia is more imminent, and we can now address this a little bit more in a specific numbers as well. But I speak of course in my own capacity, but this is the narrative in Warsaw. But there is a clear recognition of the threats coming from the south, and Poland is in fact contributing. So let me start with the Polish contribution to the south as to sort of illustrate this. Just a couple days ago, the government has finalized the decision to deploy a number of F-16 planes that will be serving as reconnaissance in the anti-ISIS campaign, which will significantly boost the capabilities of the forces there to deal with this threat. A large contingent of special forces has been sent. Poland also has sent a frigate to the Mediterranean and the Aegean Sea, which constitutes basically half of our navy is now in the Mediterranean. And as you all know, we also have some problems in the Baltic. So there is a serious consideration to the threat from the south. And as Ambassador Vezhbal said today, I think we have to stick together and do it all very much together, because in the end, both what is important for Poland and for Portugal is the golden middle that we have to hit to preserve the unity and the ambition of the alliance. But when it comes to the eastern flank, let's talk about that for a second. There have been a number of questions about threats from Russia, our perception, is it real, is it not real, what can be done. So let me just put a couple numbers on the table, just as Ambassador Vezhbal did as well. There are a few things that have changed over the last 2 years since the Wales summit that are very worrying from our perspective in Warsaw. One, Russia has positioned a very powerful S-400 rockets in the Kaliningrad region, which is a small area between, I don't have a map, but between Poland and Lithuania, is the part of Russia that is not connected directly to Russia or to Belarus. But it's in fact one of the most militarized area in Europe. But the missiles in the Kaliningrad region make it virtually impossible to reinforce the Baltic states by air in case of a conflict. We at this point would have no capacities to overcome it. And in fact, a number of studies have shown, and most recent exercise, the Anaconda that we talked about, has shown that NATO is not able to push enough soldiers quickly enough to the Baltics before Russia takes them over, if they choose to do so. General Hodges just said so yesterday, based on the outcome of the exercise, Anaconda, which was not a provocative exercise. It was only an exercise showing how NATO would reinforce Baltics in case of the conflict. So we have a A2AD problem. The other problem we have is the number is just the force-to-force ratio. Russians have more than 10 times as many forces in the region and have shown that they are able to move additional 80,000 troops very, very quickly. What NATO is now talking about and what has been decided at the NATO ministerial is to place on a rotational but persistent basis 4 to 4,500 troops. So this is nowhere near threatening to Russia. This is barely scratching the surface on the deterrence. But it's, of course, very welcome move. And the third big worry is the nuclear threats that Russia has been throwing in the direction of really the whole NATO, but particularly Baltic member states and Poland. And these are not empty threats. There is clear information about Russia developing low-yield nuclear weapons, so tactical nuclear weapons. They have changed their doctrine that talks about using tactical nuclear weapons in conventional conflicts in case they are faced with larger conventional warfare. So it's now in Russia's nuclear doctrine that NATO is an enemy, and that in case of a conflict, Russia should use small nuclear weapon to basically scare off the alliance. They have developed them, and they have either placed already or threatened to place nuclear-tipped Iskanders in Kaliningrad. So this all, in my view, and many in the view of many in Warsaw, are not empty threats. And this comes only on top of, sorry for this, on top of annexation of Crimea and the war in Ukraine. So I think we have a real challenge on our hands. And of course, we should all ask ourselves, why should Russia do this? It's a crazy idea to go to war with NATO. They will surely lose at the end. And I think we agree that they would lose in the end. The problem right now is that in the midterm, we actually have low capacity to protect the Baltic states in particular. We also know that the foreign policy of Russia is very much driven by domestic considerations and domestic threats. So Putin has shown both in Crimea, then in Ukraine, and in Syria as well, that he uses foreign adventures to build up his support at home. And that's the scenario, unlikely scenario that we think it is, that prompts us to emphasize the importance of deterrence of the eastern flank. And what the expectations from the NATO summit, from the Warsaw NATO summit, are good. The four battalions, many of you know the details, the four battalions plus the U.S. brigade is a good news. This constitutes a shift from Wales' strategy of quick reinforcement to Warsaw's strategy of limited deterrence. It's limited because these forces can be easily overcome, but importantly, they certainly will serve as tripwire in a situation of conflict. So I think that the threat is very serious, but Poland is not against dialogue with Russia, and here we very much agree. We have to keep the channels open. We would not, there is really no other countries that would like to have peaceful, democratic Russia on our borders. We are the most affected by this. Poland has been very open in the OSCE framework for this. Unfortunately, we are not seeing a great, great sort of willingness for Russia to engage in this one. But we should continue to try. So I will conclude on the on the thought that, you know, just emphasizing that from the perspective of Warsaw, even though we see Russia as a potential existential threat, that Russia has proved that it's trying to be there. We very much believe in the 360 approach, the emphasis on the South as much as the East, and we're actually putting our money where the mouth is by contributing to the South. Thank you.
Thank you. Dar agora a palavra, Dr. Alan, antigo diretor.
Give the floor to Álvaro Vasconcelos, the former director of the European Union Institute for Security Studies. Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here. I would like to thank my friend Miranda Kalia for this invitation and for this initiative from the Defense Committee of our Parliament. I'm going to focus my intervention on the debate on the Warsaw Summit. What is at the core of this debate? I have focused my attention on problems in the Mediterranean, but today I'm going to focus on European problems. It seems that in the heart of the debate on the Warsaw Summit, there is the architecture of European security at stake. It was built after the fall of the Berlin Wall around two pillars. One, to construct European unity, as the General de Gaulle used to say, is to go since Portugal to Russia. So it is the unity of Europe in the wider sense of the term. So it was built around two pillars, the pillar of the European integration to the West and the pillar of an unstable relationship between NATO and Russia, the EU and Russia, and the United States and Russia. But today, this is not so. This is being contested. We should not have a simplistic vision on this, because there is a nationalist in Russia holding the reins of power, Vladimir Putin. In fact, we have now in Russia has become also a European power, and I think that at the heart of this problem we have the resurgence of nationalism, which is now weakening European unity. There is nationalism in Russia, but there is also other nationalisms in Central European countries are threatening European unity. What is going on in Poland, in Hungary, and also in countries which are at the core of European integration. And today we have a referendum in the UK, regardless of the outcome on the Brexit referendum. There is a resurgence of nationalism in UK, and whether UK stays in or out. So, what has this resurgence of nationalism has created? It has created a new form of bipolarity, a European bipolarity, not a world bipolarity. We're not back to the bipolarity of the Cold War, in which the Soviet Union was a world power, and bipolarity was on the world level. We have now a European bipolarity, which became clear with the Russian intervention in Crimea and its annexation, but also with the decisions of NATO to strengthen its military strength on the borders with Russia and also in the Baltic republics. Now, this European bipolarity started with the Russian intervention in Georgia in 2008. This intervention was successful for Russia. It guaranteed the autonomy or the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia with the military support of Russia. And this bipolarity was strengthened with the rearmament of Russia. Rearmament, when it intervened in Georgia in 2008, considered that its military strength had declined much. It was a successful military operation, but quite difficult for them. So in 2008, they started on a significant program of rearmament, the program of $700 million in a program of military rearmament for 2020. But the military rearmament of Russia will not make Russia a military superpower from the world point of view. We must consider that Russia, from the economic point of view, is a declining country, and that Russia does not have the economic capacity of the United States or that of Germany, not to talk about Russia or India. Russia is in decline. In 2030, it will be a country with an economy similar to that of Brazil, and much inferior to the great powers like the United States, China, India, and hopefully the European Union, if Europe manages to unite itself and adopts a significant political program. So this bipolarity, as I was saying, at the European level, is really anachronic now. Now we have a polycentric world where we all are all interconnected and we're all dependent on each other. And today the powers in the world are other. And today what we are concerned is the relationship with India, with China, with India, the reorganization of the international system to cope with this polycentrism. I think that bipolarity is extremely serious for European security, because in the neighboring areas of Russia there are significant Russian minorities and separatist trends which tend to support Russia. I give you the example of Abkhazia, and we tried to make some initiatives in Abkhazia to try and understand what were the feelings, the perceptions of the Abkhazians. Now, the population of Abkhazia on one hand wants to be independent, but they don't want to be independent from Russia. They would like to have a European space in which they could have relate to Russia and Europe. Let's think about the Russian minorities of the Baltic republics, which have been mentioned. A European bipolarity is a terrible dilemma for these Russian minorities, which are quite important in the Baltic republics. In some of them, they go up to they account for more than 25% of the population. So this is a dilemma for these minorities, which are culturally linked to Russia, to be in a situation of European bipolarity. Same can be said with what happened in Ukraine. The Russian minority in Ukraine felt marginalized with a very strong movement of integration to the West. But Ukraine, it is not a judgment of values, but I'm just registering a fact, and we can only make international policy starting from a realistic assessment of the facts. Now, who is interested in this bipolarity? I think Putin is interested in that. He's a nationalist leader who needs to tell his population that Russia is being threatened. And we have seen, and we were rather worried by this, that what Putin did in Ukraine, again, the support of the Russian minorities in Ukraine and also in Russia. Putin is an autocrat who has the support of the population, of the population of Russia. But bipolarization is not at all a good thing for us, because it is a factor of a disintegration of countries which are in the joint neighborhood of EU and Russia. For us, bipolarity is a disadvantage. And how can we sort out this dilemma? It is an extremely tricky dilemma. On one side, we must reassure the Poles and the Baltic republics. I'm convinced that Poland is not really militarily threatened by Russia, but this is secondary. But the Poles think that they are under threat. They have a deep perception of a threat, which is also linked to history and also to the nationalist resurgence in Poland. Of course, this military build-up of Russia in Kaliningrad seems to be an enormous threat to the Poles and must be taken in consideration. We must give security to the Poles. We also need to have a relationship of interdependence with Russia. We talked about dialogue with Russia. Of course, dialogue. But we need something more than dialogue. We must strengthen the vectors of interdependence. And this is why the economic sanctions do not seem to me the best way to do so. Of course, NATO should reassert Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, that an attack to one NATO country is an attack to NATO. Of course, it will be a message to Putin that there are limits to his action in the area of joint neighborhood. We must strengthen economic, cultural, interdependence, the interdependence of civil society. We have to maintain our ties with Russia in order to counter the nationalist options of Putin. No, we must also it will also strengthen the opposition to Putin. Now, the strengthening of Article 5 of the Washington Treaty is a good thing. We should also redirect the sanction to something more specific. And, in fact, they have an direct impact on the Russian population. And it does not facilitate any dialogue with Russia. Finally, of course, we must continue the dialogue. The NATO-Russia Council must continue this dialogue. We must also think how to resume a key idea of the Cold War, the control of armament and the dialogue on military movements. Today it's much more difficult because there's a total unbalance between the military capacity of Russia and the capacity of the West. The West is far more powerful, and this makes difficult a dialogue with the Russian regarding military capacity. And to end, just a few words on the South. Now, the South, the Middle East war, is at war. A war which goes from Syria to Libya, the border of NATO and the border of the European Union. Let's not forget that Turkey belongs to NATO and has borders with Syria. I would say that concerning the South and the Middle East, the capacity for NATO to have a significant role is very limited. The issues are being addressed in the framework of the United Nations. But NATO has a very important role to play, to make clear that the border between Turkey and Syria is a NATO border, that any attack to Turkey is an attack to the whole alliance. This has not been clearly stated in the beginning of the conflict, and I don't agree with the idea that this is an opportunity of collaboration with Russia, because the interest of Russia in Syria is to support Assad's regime, who has committed crimes against humanity, and our policy should be support the opposition, which is against Assad. Of course, this is a long process, but of course, I don't think that this is that we don't think that ISIS is a superpower. It does not correspond to reality, although it doesn't have so much strength. It is an organization which can create tremendous problems, as we have seen in many European cities. It has to do with the policies, with the internal European policies. We have done very little to put an end to the conflict in Syria. I would end my speech by saying that in order to reconstruct this framework of European unity and to improve relations with our neighbors at the east and the south, we must refocus on the two pillars, that of the European Union and NATO. And the fragility of the axis of the European Union is a very significant problem which prevents us to reach this objective, European unity. So, hence our concern of the future of the European unity must be at the core of our concern. The absence from the EU, from the conflicts of the Middle East, is a very serious problem. And I think that cooperation in the Middle East is not necessarily cooperation between EU and NATO. It is a cooperation between EU and NATO. And we have to strengthen in the general framework of transatlantic relations not only the EU and NATO relationship, which have a more restricted domain, and also the relations between the European Union and the United States. But the European Union must have a common voice, and this is not yet guaranteed today. Thank you. So now I give the floor to General Valence Pintu. Good afternoon. My greetings to the President of the Committee on National Defense, my greetings to all my colleagues of the panel. So, I'm speaking standing because I'm a soldier. A soldier who sits is not good. To speak last means that the speaker does not have much to say. No. We are waiting that the game will not be prolonged and that there won't be any penalties. Anyway, I would like to honor the invitation that has been extended to me. I'm going to give my point of view on the NATO summit in Warsaw. Just a perspective on the summit, not an analysis on European security. Now, this is a very personal point of view that I'm going to give to you, two reasons, because it represents my point of view, and I don't have access to any privileged information. Now, this is not going to be a glamorous summit leading to new strategic concepts of the alliance. But it will, in fact, be very important. Nevertheless, as it's natural, the summit agenda will be full of very important topics, and it would be very surprising if this summit would not be successful, and it would produce a long statement focused on three or four specific issues served by a very rounded-up speech which can please all the 28 allies. But maybe we could see something more in this, trying to have a look behind the curtain. Even if it's not written anyway, the true agenda of the Warsaw Summit, the one which really matters, will be focused on three crucial issues. The safeguard, or better, the construction of a true harmony between the viewpoints and the trends of the European allies, those from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, to address the challenges to which they are confronted, and also better unity with the European Union and the preservation of the political instruments in order to resume cooperation with Russia when there will be other circumstances in Moscow. So this is what I would keep in mind if I would have any responsibilities in this summit. Generally speaking, the summit will be aimed at guaranteeing the good functioning of the alliance in the present geopolitical context of the present, but adapting this to the we need to adjust to a new defense environment. Now we have Putin's attitude and the migrant crisis, two big problems. We need to strengthen collective defense, and we will have also to review the present cooperation policies, and if one is more oriented to the European East, the other one has to do with the needs of Southern Europe. There should not be any contradiction or rupture between these two direction of efforts. Even if we think about the vital interests of the states, the challenge of the East seems to be more direct than the challenges of the South, which are more complex in their manifestations and in their potential answers. The first are political, diplomatic, and military. The second are political, diplomatic, military, economic, social, and cultural. And they also demand interventions based on the model of comprehensive approach. As to the strengthening of collective defense, I can forecast that this summit will take the same way taken in the Wales summit in 2014. Then the alliance had to review the ideas of the strategic concept and the allied deterrence. When we talked about this in 2010, we did not ignore that the nuclear was not a deterrence from the classic warfare. We thought that it would not be, there would not be any occasion to offer deterrence to conventional forces. But this was denied in Crimea, after what happened in Crimea. So in Wales, we decided that deterrence, nuclear deterrence, would be part of the deterrence of the alliance. Then there was the presence of allied forces in the east of Europe, in Eastern European countries, and in conventional military exercise of some significance, and also, and they were deemed to be secondary before. Now, we need to provide a more institutional character to this purpose, placing forces in the Baltic states and in Poland, and also to ensure a quick answer and the preparedness of these forces to answer any bellicose action. I would like also to draw your attention, if there is American the American decide to strengthen the forces, it means it is a rapid strengthening of the military capacity in Europe, and this is a new challenge for Europe. But we should know whether from 2014 to now whether there are new facts which cause these change to make permanent the presence of forces and general headquarters in the East, and what are the consequences of this new positioning in terms of relationship with Russia. So we also need to recover, go back to improve our ties with Russia. After the intervention in Crimea and in Ukraine, Russia has been intrusive. It has tried to make more difficult the access of NATO means to various areas, especially in sovereign states of the Baltic countries. It has just been gesticulating a lot, and will have to apply measures of reduction of risks while maintaining an opening to dialogue. The formal position of the alliance is not to recognize a direct threat from Moscow and try to preserve the NATO-Russia Founding Act from 1997, despite the aggressive attitude of Putin. Of course, we have the summit, we'll need a mermaid. This is a mythical figure in the arms of Warsaw. Let's not be seduced by the chance of the mermaid and be fall into illusions. In this answer to the East, we need to consider three other issues: the anti-missile defense, the nuclear posture, and the enlargement. All these are going to be dealt with during the summit. As to the anti-missile defense, it seems normal that the alliance should conclude phase 3 of its plan, installing in Poland what it was planning to install for a long time ago. But maybe it would be sensible that after that they should not rush into phase 4, which is not well defined. As to the nuclear posture, although there is despite the rhetorics of Russia in its recent strategic documents, seems to that now we have to be very careful and we should not take great decisions due to the following reasons. On one hand, we are sure that this issue could provoke big divides among the allies. So, maybe the American elections will influence it's not going to influence the summit, but there is going to be an influence on the nuclear issue. Now, the topic of enlargement is a classic of all NATO summits. I don't think there's going to be any surprise as to the fact that of the candidacy of Montenegro, then there's also Bosnia, Kosovo, and at the end of the tunnel, Serbia. And then the cases of Ukraine and Georgia will be also examined. Maybe the Russia should not have any droit de regard on the free choices of the candidates to the alliance and the decisions of NATO. But we should not also take decisions without any strong reasons, and we should not aggravate the relations between NATO and Russia. What happened in the Bucharest summit in 2008, forcing the invitation to Georgia and Ukraine, was to give illusions to these countries. And they became, in fact, it was a way of eternally putting back their candidacy. So this was a consequence of the chanting of some mermaids. We have to be pragmatic in all this. We have to assess the situation to see how our decision can be useful to NATO. And, of course, we have to favor the idea of a completely free Europe. Of course, our first... We should not deny the essence of NATO as a political space of freedom, solidarity, and democracy. Of course, in this alliance, without any declared enemy, with two fronts, one on the east, one on the south, we should elaborate on the southern flank. In fact, I don't accept the idea of the southern flank. What we have is a front on the south and a front on the east. In the south, we are aware of the dangers from the Middle East, but we don't hear so much from the dangers from North Africa and Sahel. And the Sahel, both are dangers to the alliance. Both are aligned. Dangers which can fall into the context of Article 5. Of course, these are issues of which are political and social, which need answers, which cannot be satisfied, obtain a satisfying answer in the framework of NATO. In fact, NATO, we suppose that NATO cannot cause stability in the south. In fact, we need experts from the European Union to sort out these problems in the south. We need cooperation between both organizations, NATO and EU, because the revision of the cooperation policies of NATO, in the sense of their strengthening, will be a very important topic in the Warsaw Summit. The alliance needs to revise its cooperation mechanisms, partnership for peace, the dialogue for the Mediterranean, and also the agreement of Istanbul. We have to not to close these concepts in rigid formula. We have 28. Those NATO men plus one or two, in order to go deeper in a true cooperation in such or such field. But NATO is also following the options and the practices of the neighborhood policies of the EU. We have to conjugate efforts and priorities with the EU and NATO, and we have to choose criteriously among the non-European partners, those who can be a source of example in and cooperation in a first phase. This would be a very good thing, and the summit should exploit this possibility. I'm thinking about Morocco, Tunisia, Jordan. They should be identified as priority destinies of cooperation. Of course, nothing can replace the attention which must be given to the Libyan case, to Syria, to Iraq, and Afghanistan. In fact, none of this is likely of a positive evolution by armed intervention. They need cooperation from the EU. We must avoid fiascos, as was the intervention in Libya in 2012. Such fiascos cannot be repeated. In fact, if we have more fiascos, we might lose some military support from NATO, like the help that NATO gives in the Mediterranean, or some we have to open and maintain open channels of dialogue with the Arab League and with the European Union. This is very important, and of course, but some of the Eastern allies are not so, may not be so available for this southern flank. This would be a terrible mistake. Now remember that on the east there are some forces from Western Europe, and in the south we rely on the European partnership with the Eastern countries. But what we have to, what has been done in the summit, is to share a joint set of interests. For each interest, of course, there's going to be different degrees of interest. This is only how we can counter the trend of the renationalization of defense policies. So we need to understand that at some time there was a strong trend to have a common enemy, but nowadays there is no common enemy. If we don't decide to share our interests, the NATO summit in Warsaw will run the risk of just not being a success. If the allies can adequate the alliance to realities, to strengthen it, to give it a new sense, thanks to a model or a pattern of collective security against no predefined adversary or enemy, but through a collective defense system. Regardless of the outcome of the referendum in UK today, it is not certain that the European Union will change its foreign policies and security policies. If UK leaves us, this failure will not be the fault of the EU, but to its 28 members of NATO. But one thing is sure, that these changes, these evolutions of external and security police of the EU really mean that prove the continuity and the valorization of NATO. To this, NATO cannot have Putin's Russia as a reason of existence. It would be a very poor reason to exist. What some would like to see and define as a going back of NATO to Cold War can only be considered as a negation of the fact that NATO has won the Cold War, or impoverishment of a bigger development for Europe and the world. NATO today must be focused on the security of its member and the safeguard of a common civilization model, its unity, cohesion, and solidarity. The present circumstances imply that it must be vigilant in the South and also in the East, and also addressing issues in the East and the South. Thank you very much. It must be based on common principles. Thank you very much.
Parece-me dispensável estar a perguntar se haverá intervenção.
Well, I guess it is useless to ask if there are questions due to the fact that lunchtime is getting close. So I don't know which flank we are on, but anyway, I have to ask if any of the presents wish to ask a question. If it is not the case, but yes, apparently there is one question.
I'm very happy that Álvaro Vasconcelos is here, and I would like to ask him a question which has to do with what is now happening before the Warsaw Summit. He mentioned that we are now involved in the reassessment of the architecture of European defense. It is necessary to strengthen the presence of NATO. We all agree that the defense of Europe is not only of NATO's responsibility. The European pillar is also fundamental, and I would like to ask a question on this. I would like to ask whether maybe this NATO strand is being asserted, but maybe would it not be better to go back to the idea of the creation and development of a European entity of defense within NATO rather than starting with this very difficult ideal of a common policy of security and defense? Maybe it's, or a future European army to defend the territory. Thank you. Any other question? I agree to what you said, that one strong point should be the cooperation policy. Could you expand on this? What could be the role of Portugal, considering that its role in NATO, when we think about the threat from Maghreb and the north of Africa? The second for you, Professor. I think that it is really crucial for the European project to have a common policy of defense and security. We were able to build up free circulation, common currency system, and now we are now in the middle of the process of European construction. And I would say that how can we do that? Because it is absolutely indispensable for our European project to have a European defense. Just would like to ask a question. Jean Rochebrune, an international security consultant. Of course, there was the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it was said today that this led to a new phase in NATO policies. And now with these disagreements as to the refugee policies, when about 70 walls were built in Europe, and that some of them EU member countries do not agree on fundamental issues, because we're talking about human rights after all, would it not be prejudicial in the construction of the so-called architecture of European architecture of security? Can you introduce yourself? My name is Barcelona. I'm in the Navy. I would like to go back to a point mentioned by General Valença Pinto, that is enlargement. NATO says that enlargement is a factor of the extension of stability, that we have to respect, and we have to pursue a policy of the open door. But we cannot drift like this. And remembering the past, the crisis that we had after the Bucharest summit, which led to the suspension of the dialogue between NATO and Russia, and we had here in Europe President Medvedev at a meeting. In fact, there was a clear policy on enlargement, that the enlargement to Ukraine and Georgia would be just into parentheses. It was just for the Baltic states. But it does not succeed like this, and the result is not brilliant. We have contradictory visions within NATO on this enlargement, and I think that a decision or a consensus on this matter must be reached. Otherwise, how can we envisage an improvement of our relations with Russia? So what can be the geostrategic or political consequences of the enlargement of NATO? In physics, I learned that everything which is enlarged is diluted, an effect of dilution. So maybe it's something that we could talk and reflect on previously in order to avoid damage. Now I'm going to give the floor to all the members of the panel to make some considerations on these topics. So I'm going to start with I'm going to give the floor to the to General Valença Pinto. Of course. I'm just going to say a few words to say the following. During my intervention, I expressed some reserves as to the eventuality of a common policy of security and defense, but this was a bit. I don't think that it will exist in this matter. I'm not a Eurosceptic or a Euro-optim. I am a Euro-resolute. I think that if I don't have that, I won't have Europe. This is quite clear. We do need a common defense. I think that Portugal can have a role in cooperation policy. It can have a role as a member. We don't have to have any grandiose vision on the role we could play. But what we have is the possibility to participate to NATO and the European Union. We can play a role which will avoid duplication. We can be, our action could be complementary, and we can be quite useful within these organizations in the future. There's another aspect in which we can contribute, that is the relations with the African Union, maybe the Arab League, and our partners are in Africa and in the Sahelian region. We all know that it's not possible to set up a fruitful multilateral relation without any good bilateral cooperation. And if Portugal can help in this, I think Portugal can add something with a larger scope in the sense of European cooperation and also within NATO, thanks to his our links with Africa and with the Arab League. A few years ago, a friend of mine was during the course to be promoted to general officers, asked me. I had a difficult question to answer, and it was a question of the relationship between NATO and the African Union, and nothing could be found. But maybe we could help in this without having any grandiose visions of our action. I quite agree with what Admiral Basila said as to the enlargement. What happened, we don't have to go into details, what happened in Bucharest was wrong. It was normal to reserve enlargement to the Eastern Balkans, not to exclude so much Ukraine and Georgia, but for the reason that Ukraine and Georgia were not in the situation to enter the pipeline, the membership action plan. And this is why they still are, due to the worst reasons. And enlargement have limits. Civilization and cultural identity should not be diluted by enlargement. And there are many political difficulties in the Western Balkans. There can't be any stability without Serbia. Serbia is somewhat distant to the to joining NATO. It should not be kept too far away from this process. I would like to thank your question on European policy of defense and security. It is very important in my view, given the changes happening in the world and in the United States, the security and defense that America can offer to Europe is bound to be reduced in the future. So the big issues now belong to the neighborhood of Europe. I don't think that Europe can become a world power capable of intervening in the Taiwan Strait. It is the United States which are going to be more concerned with what is going on in the South China Seas or in the Strait of Taiwan. Well, the practical example of this is the Syrian problem. Syria has become a conflict with very serious consequences for Europe, but an enormous impact on European policy, hence resurgence of European nationalism, with crimes against humanity. The Americans were not present to help us with Syria. This was during the Obama administration. And after Obama, what is going to happen? More interventionism or more isolationism? So the tendency has been for the Americans to be more focused on the Pacific theater rather than being present in Europe. European Union will continue to be a regional power, with regional problems. We've seen that it was not able to sort out the problem in Syria, in Libya, the problems of its own neighborhood. So in the future, this issue of the common and external policy will be another it's not going to be a phase for us to be more united. This was like that before Maastricht. Now, it will become a vital issue for the security of Europe. How can Europe defend itself if it does not have a common policy of security of defense? I think that during the Obama administration, we should have taken the necessary steps to obtain this. Obama was quite favorable to this common defense policy, and we don't know what is going to happen after. And we missed this opportunity. I published a book with Mike Baranowski, it was called the Obama moment. It was saying this, Europe has to take advantage of the Obama moment. And this was my first comment on the common policy, security or defense. But I'm not really optimistic that it's going to happen in the short term. But I think that in the middle term, problems will become so crucial that this particular issue will have to be addressed. If we look at European integration and its UEFA, I think the Europe will be a more Europe of variable geometry, with a Europe of deep integration of all the member states. And Germany will play an important role in the social, financial, and economic integration. And the Franco-English axis, it will be very important. I think Brexit can be an extremely serious problem for the future. If the UK leaves EU, there will still be cooperation in the defense area, but it will be extra-European, and it will cause problems also to Portugal. Portugal wants also be to all advance nuclear of European integration. We were in everything, in the euro, in external in policy of common security and peace. And now, the refugee issue is also the symptom of the resurgence of nationalism in the European Union. This is which is being weakened by all this surge of nationalism. It means the renationalization of European policies. In the past, we thought that European Union is safe, that it will exist forever. We believed in the progress of the European construction. I am one of those who considers that there is an existential risk to the future of the European Union. European civil society must reorganize itself to stand and fight for the continuation of the European project, because there is a serious risk to the future of the EU. The enlargement of NATO, well, here I think that there are two steps to consider. Two spaces. The space outside the former Soviet Union, including the Balkans. The enlargement of NATO is natural, should not create any serious problems to European security. But the enlargement to countries which belonged members of the Soviet Union, I don't think they make much sense from the point of view of European security. I'd agree with the general. These countries have the right to make their own international options, but there we also make strategic calculations. There are also the strategic interests of Russia to be considered. So we have to recognize this, that Russia has its own strategic concerns and interests. The Russians consider that they received guarantees that there would not be any enlargement of NATO when there was the reunification of Germany. Gorbachev says yes, and then he says the contrary. And Gorbachev was the interlocutor during these discussions. Very difficult to say if this was really affirmed and if this guarantee was given. And the Russians say that this guarantee was given, that there would not be any further enlargement. So if we think of what happened at the fall of Berlin, everything was given. Everybody was ready to give this guarantee. We wanted Poland, the Czech Republic, and the others could free themselves from the Soviet domination. So we would say you accept the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact on exchange that we're not going to cause problems in your borders. From the point of view of political realism, that makes sense. Whether this was said or not, I don't know. But I would like to say that if the enlargement of NATO for the neighboring countries of Russia, of the Russian Federation, seems very problematic to me, the enlargement of the European Union seems possible to me from the political point of view, but difficult from the institutional point of view. Can the European Union integrate Russia, Moldova, Armenia, Georgia? That it has to find forms of integration, for instance, with Ukraine. It is also a way to guaranteeing security. The country strongly linked to the EU has more guarantee from the internal point of view. It is these internal problems that they have, these separatist forces, which really mind them. So we need to help them by helping them to join the European Union. Thank you very much. Give the floor to Michael Baranowski.
Thank you very much, and fascinating discussion. Let me pick on a couple of the points. Maybe one easy to start with is NATO enlargement. Just from the point that this is, yes, Montenegro was invited, but this is in fact very much not on the agenda of the Warsaw Summit. I have just hosted the Georgian and Macedonian defense ministers in Warsaw for a conversation on this, and talked recently with Ukrainians. It's interesting to hear their perspective, knowing very well that the NATO enlargement is not on the agenda for them for a very, very long time. And we can we can, you know, and we should definitely discuss the validity of this point altogether. But you know, it's not something that is expected out of Warsaw or immediately after Warsaw. But I think the larger point that I wanted to sort of make and respond a little bit is how do we set up relations with Russia going forward? And that's what, you know, a lot of our conversation here is about. And we are struggling with this in Warsaw very much as well. But I think we have to recognize a couple basic tenets of it. That one is, it really takes two to tango, right? We have to want it as the West, but they have to want it as well. And then it's a question on what basis and on what values. I think all agree in this room that Russia has broke very basic tenets of international law by, you know, at the least annexing Crimea. There is an ongoing war in Ukraine. You know, these are really very basic principles, not only within the European security system, but within the, you know, the global security system. And others are looking as well how the democratic world will respond to these challenges. So I think, you know, the first decision we have to make is, do we let it slide? Do we cooperate on the rules that they suggest? And Russian leadership has been very clear about creating a sphere of influence in its neighborhood that does not recognize sovereignty of these countries, territorial integrity, and certainly not their ability to choose alliances. And by the way, all these three principles and many others have been enshrined in the Helsinki principles to which Soviet Union agreed 40 years ago. So, I mean, we are really, this is a really an important moment in which way we go. And the case I would make is that if we don't stick to the principles, will have trouble not only on the boundaries and the proximity of Russia that we are seeing, you know, that are there right now, right? That there is a war in Ukraine and frozen conflicts in Georgia, Moldova, Nagorno-Karabakh, and they are all flaring up. But we'll have problems elsewhere as well. So I think this is, you know, this is obviously a much larger discussion, but I think this is the, you know, the clear choice that is ahead of us, and you know that I would emphasize how unstable the situation really is, because the instability is the tool that Russia is using right now to keep, especially the countries that are not part of NATO, off balance. But if you talk with the Balts, they feel kind of off balance as well. The last short piece would be on the common European defense, and I would be all for it. A lot of my compatriots would be all for it. I think it's a long way to go, and I'm crossing the fingers and holding thumbs for Britain to remain, because this is the one thing that would really, you know, kill any dreams of that going forward. But I think that the even more important question for us to focus on in the short term is really producing capabilities. And I think, you know, Americans will be in Europe for a while, and over the long term, I think we are absolutely, several of the speakers said, I mean, there are strategic challenges in Russia. They are in Asia. You know, they are back in Europe just for a moment. Yeah. But you know, it's the capabilities that we have trouble with overall. If we can move on this, both in terms of spending but also in terms of integration, the cooperation will come out of this. There has to be a better political moment for this. I mean, creating a European army at a moment where one of the major European member states wants to leave and the populations in many others are questioning validity of Europe is probably not the moment, but hopefully the moment would come. Thanks.
Muito obrigado. And now the floor to Ambassador Loboglu. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. I know it's late, so I'll be very brief. Just three comments. Number one, I think we have to be realistic about our expectations from the Warsaw Summit. What we can expect is a demonstration of solidarity, an expression of self-confidence, and a NATO that's looking forward. The second is, I think there should be no impression here that in the equation between the eastern flank and the southern flank, NATO has the dilemma of choosing one over the other or giving more priority over the other. That's not the message, at least, that I'm trying to give. But we have to remember that security is indivisible. And I think the risks and threats emanating from the south are as real and probably closer to happening than what we are facing in Eastern Europe. And finally, on European defense identity, I think it's a very unrealistic and perhaps inappropriate expectation in the sense that Europe has not even been able to remove the problem of Cyprus from the way of an effective cooperation between EU and NATO. And I think, you know, Europe that has so many other problems probably should focus on other areas rather than creating a common European army. In this connection, that's my last word. NATO must maintain the open door policy and keep enlarging. Thank you.
Resta-me agradecer todos aqueles que participaram neste.
Thank you very much to all those that have been involved on this panel. I'm not going to make any conclusions over this long debate. My conclusions are difficult to do, but messages remain. And I would like to reaffirm the interest to this event, and I would like to invite you all to go for lunch, namely the guest speakers. Thank you very much to all of you.